You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert. We have been so consumed with the nonstop reality TV show unfolding in Washington that we have spent precious little time here on one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world right now, and that is the mass displacement of the Rohingya minority in Myanmar, also known as Burma. A UN report has accused Myanmar's military of gang rapes and mass killings with, quote, genocidal intent. In the past year, an estimated 700,000 Rohingya have fled into refugee camps across the border with Bangladesh. There now appears to be a similar campaign building against the country's Karen minority. All this in the wake of what was initially billed as a peaceful transition from military rule to democracy. Our next guest has spent the past several years collecting stories of what has happened inside Myanmar and inside the refugee camps sprawling across its borders. Jean Marie Hollacy's latest documentary is called Mother, Daughter, Sister. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Could you start by taking us into the present moment and just kind of describe conditions in the camps where you've been shooting?
To give listeners an idea of where these camps are, the Rohingya, who are the Muslims that you referred to that have been the subject of ethnic cleansing, were living in western Burma in a state called Rakhine State, sharing that state with another ethnic group who are the Rakhine. And when the ethnic cleansing occurred during the military operations that resulted in this mass exodus, they fled by foot across the river and land into neighboring Bangladesh. So that is now the largest refugee camp in the world. There are 1 million Rohingya living in extremely deplorable conditions. They have in crowded small huts that are built on sandy silt that have had many challenges with the monsoon season. Their water and sanitation facilities are insufficient, but moreover, the psychological impact of what all of these people have endured from witnessing and or suffering from these heinous human rights abuses that were carried out against them have largely been left unaddressed due to a lack of resources.
So the refugee camps are being administered by the United Nations, not by the government of Bangladesh.
It's both. The United Nations High Commission on Refugees can only operate with consult with the host government. So the government of Bangladesh is clearly a part of that, and they have been lauded for their efforts to accept. Bangladesh itself is a very small, densely populated and impoverished country. So to accept 1 million people into its borders was no small feat of humanitarian assistance. However, it is creating some taxing situations, both for the natural resources in that area, as well as just what the long-term proposal is going to be for the return of these people, because they cannot indefinitely stay there.
Right. So maybe we should back up a second and kind of do the basic background, starting with like who the Rohingya
Sure.
are as a people.
So Burma is comprised of multiple different ethnic nationalities, of which there are major groupings such as the Kachin, the Shan, the Karen. And the dominant nationality, the Bama, are the Burmans, who are the ones who largely rule the country in positions of government and certainly in the military. One of the ethnic states is called Rakhine State, and the Rakhine are themselves an ethnic group that has long been neglected by the central government. So there's been a lack of infrastructure, endemic poverty in that area. The Rohingya are a self-identified group who are Muslim, who are distinctly different from other Muslims in Burma, and they have lived there, according to their own documentation and their testimonies, for centuries. The porous border that it shares with Bangladesh has meant that there has been a lot of cross-migration over the decades between both Bangladesh and Western Burma, which is Rakhine State, where they live. But the Rohingya have been systematically oppressed by the Burmese government, and they have not been granted citizenship. So as stateless people, they are not able to access even the most basic services in their country. But more than that, they are systematically persecuted. They are prevented from traveling. They are prevented from work. They are denied access to health care, to education, and have also sadly been the subject of a very vehement and despicable campaign of racism that has largely been carried out through the spreading of wildfire rumors on Facebook.
Okay, let's untangle those several factors. So first of all, the statelessness has been extant for a long time.
Correct.
Without the kind of pogroms that we're seeing today. What led them to be in that stateless status initially? What did the government get out of denying a substantial minority any kind of citizenship rights?
Well, in fact, it's a complex history, but to surmise, there was a time when members of the Burmese government, central government, acknowledged the existence of the Rohingya, which currently is not being acknowledged at all. Mm-hmm. Even the word, the usage of the word now is so inflammatory in Burma that I dare not utter that word when I'm working there, because it creates such an outlash from people who say, no, they don't even exist. There is no such thing as Rohingya. That's how far the hysteria has reached at this point. But they have been there. There's evidence of that, historical evidence. But in 1982, the Burmese military government, which was in power for half a century, enacted a new citizenship law that stripped the Rohingya from being listed as one of the eligible ethnic nationalities to get a citizenship card or a national verification card. So that kind of sealed the fate in the last several decades. But there has clearly been resistance fueled by some of the more ultra-nationalist groups that have sway both over the civilian population, but also have cohorts inside the military government who are making decisions to systematically exclude them from being part of what they consider to be the Union of Myanmar that is comprised of these other groups. So they want them out.
So what was the spark that took their status from a people that is marginalized and, you know, denied some rights and privileges to a group that is forcibly displaced?
Yeah, I would say it wasn't just the denial of rights and privileges. It was what the United Nations has described as the most oppressed people in the world. I mean, I just named a few of the restrictions upon them, but they've literally been in essentially apartheid-style conditions in the areas in which they have been living in Rakhine State. In 2012, it was the first spark of violence that occurred, and there was an alleged rape that was blamed upon a Muslim Rohingya, and that led to mass mob rule that took over the capital of that state, Sitwe, and that led to the first displacement of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya out of the capital city into the camps in which they continue to languish now. That was the first incident of violence that occurred. Subsequently, this self-described Rohingya militant group erupted onto the scene. They call themselves ARSA. By all accounts, they are a ragtag, loosely bound organization that doesn't really have a specific mandate of leadership, and have themselves, by reports documented by Amnesty International, coerced or pressured Rohingya men to join them in this effort of armed resistance, a very futile effort against the Burmese military. The ARSA militants launched an attack that was timed with the release of a United Nations report that Kofi Annan, the late Kofi Annan, led, investigating the subsequent conditions from the 2012 violence to say, what can we do? How do we get out of this situation? What is necessary for the social, economic, and political infrastructure to create more equity and sustainable dignity in this community for both Rohingya and Rakhine? So the ARSA militants timed it with the release of that report, I think quite consciously, to disrupt the report. And they attacked a few Burmese border guard posts and killed some border guard posts. That led to what was then this massive crackdown that has minimally been called crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing, but is now, as you mentioned, being investigated for intent of genocide. That was documented widely by groups such as Human Rights Watch, where there was a scorched earth policy. Hundreds of Rohingya villages were burned to the ground. There was satellite imagery to confirm that. Thousands have been killed. And there was also clear evidence, which is the subject of our film, about the use of rape as a weapon of war.
Yeah. And those interviews are brutal. I want to stay with politics in Myanmar for one more second before we get into it. If we kind of make the assumption that the Burmese military does not actually see the Rohingya as a serious threat militarily, it leaves the question of what the Burmese government and the Burmese military get out of waging a campaign of genocide against this particular minority. Are they being pushed by popular sentiment? Are they getting something out of stoking popular sentiment? Like, what's the political incentive structure here?
It's an excellent question, and one that would have a myriad of answers, but I think you've touched upon one of the theories, which is, yes, they do get some political leverage from the populist support that also sees them as the necessary heroes to protect the nation state of Burma, Myanmar, which sees itself as a Buddhist identity country. So the identity politics of Burma, which has been used by the military to leverage this idea of fear and the sense of the other, that these Muslims are not from us, they're going to threaten our existence. And it gives a justification for the expansion of military operations in the area and for their continued role as a central hero in this ongoing, somewhat rocky transition they are making to democracy. There are other factors that analysts and journalists have looked into that are more rooted in some of the economic benefits that could be gained from clearing that area. The largest single dual pipeline project in Southeast Asia right now, which is in partnership with the Myanmar military and China, is a gas and oil pipeline that runs from the Bay of Bengal all the way across Rakhine State through Rohingya communities to provide the gas and oil into China. So there are also resources in that area. The development of that deep sea port project was seen by many as being a benefit to certain members of the military who are engaged in that. So I think that there is certainly some factors that should be looked at more thoroughly, that, it, as you said, it didn't just come from the air. It's the great question. The simplest questions are often the most pressing. Why? Why now? What sparked this? And who is actually gaining from this? Unfortunately, Myanmar as a whole, the people of Burma, are also not gaining from this, because the international reputation of the country has forced some foreign direct investors to rethink whether or not they want to be in a country with this kind of instability. And certainly the democracy leader, the state councillor Aung San Suu Kyi, has been vilified across the international community for her failure to speak up about this ethnic cleansing and perhaps genocide.
Yeah. In my setup for the interview, I described this as something that was happening despite Myanmar's transition to democracy. But you're describing at least one of the dynamics being the military in handing over control of the country to an elected civilian government.
Precisely.
Kind of has to justify its institutional power, and this is one way to do that. Do you think we can place some blame on the actual democratization process?
There's no doubt that the democratization process in Myanmar is something that would, for any country having emerged from 50 continuous years of absolute military control, would have been considered challenging, to say the least. And Aung San Suu Kyi and her government, although they won the popular vote, do not, in fact, control the country. The key ministries in the country, such as the border affairs, the home affairs ministries, not nevertheless the defense ministries, are all in the pockets of the military. Moreover, the parliament in Myanmar, which is their Congress, is still dictated by the military. Why? Because the constitution passed under the military regime, written by the military, that was voted upon during a cyclone, if you can imagine, enshrined military control in the parliament by way of saying that 25% of all seats are appointed by the military. In order to pass legislation in Myanmar, Burma, you need 76% votes.
So the military gave itself a veto.
Correct.
We're speaking to Jean Marine Halisi, a human rights documentarian who has been documenting the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya Muslim minority inside Burma. She's been filming on both sides of Burma's border with Bangladesh, where the world's largest refugee camp is now sheltering somewhere between 700,000 and a million Rohingya. Let's talk about the people you've been interviewing inside that camp. First of all, the stories in your latest film, Mother, Daughter, Sister, are brutal. And they're about the weaponization of rape in the course of ethnic cleansing. How much does it take to get someone to open up about what they've been through?
Whenever you are interviewing a survivor of any human rights abuse, there is always an approach that has to be taken, I think, purely from the heart, and having a circle of compassion exuding from you as you're meeting that person and asking them to share their vital testimony with you. And it is something that I approach with a tremendous amount of responsibility. This subject in particular, because it dealt with sexual violence and rape as a weapon of war, including, as you saw in the film, against teenagers. One of our the characters in our film, Dil Kayas, is a 16-year-old girl who was brutally gang raped in a schoolhouse, along with a group of other girls taken from her village, and lost her entire family of 8 brothers and sisters and her parents. The cruelty of rape in any context, whether it is in a conflict setting as presented in our film, or even in our country, in the setting of the United States, in the social setting of rape in the general society, has a particular impact of trauma upon those who survive, which is unlike other forms of survival of abuse that often affects the survivor for their entire lifetime. It is something that is very complicated too by other factors, such as Dil Kayas, the young teenager in our film, who's not educated, who therefore doesn't have the toolkit of empowerment to see herself as somebody that can transcend what happened to her and not take on the culpability that rape survivors often feel for the crime that was committed against them. The fear that's instilled in people, the self-doubt and the complete crushing of any sense of security of one's body and soul is taken away by this act of rape. And the rapes that were carried out in Burma, what we were trying to depict in our film, because as you've seen, Brian, the film focuses both on Rohingya survivors and Kachin, who are another ethnic group in northern Burma, where there is still war going on. There is not only conflict in the Rohingya communities in Burma, there is a full-scale war still going on right now in Burma, in Kachin State, that has displaced hundreds of thousands of refugees there. And we were trying to make a clear, clear story that showed the pattern of evidence that this is not something new that the Burmese military has done only against the Rohingya. In fact, they have been using rape as a weapon of war systematically against ethnic women, and not just women, girls, children, even elderly women who have survived this. And this heinous crime is something that we wanted to bring to the fore, not just to expose the crime itself, but to underline the fact that women survivors and women human rights community activists have the agency to help themselves, and they are not victims. They are women who have particular skills for organizing themselves, educating, even through informal education, the survivors who have endured this. And this is a call that we're trying to make, is to support women to be able to have the tools that they need to expand their local NGO efforts to address these issues.
Most of the women you speak to obviously hope to return to Myanmar at some point. They hope things will change in the country. It strikes me that putting their faces and their names on camera exposes them to the prospect of retaliation should they return.
Tremendous courage on the part of the young girls who shared their stories with us, the women who were witnesses to some of the brutal rapes that you saw in the film, who were Rohingya, but also the tremendous courage of the Kachin women who are living in Burma, who are not in a refugee camp outside of the country, in a relatively safer area, who I thought were so powerful. One of the great quotes I felt towards the end of the film is, the Kachin story is focused upon the brutal rape and murder of 2 volunteer school teachers in Kachin State. And the story revolves around their older sister and mother, respectively, who are now standing up to fight for justice for this, to say, no, we're not just going to stay quiet. And the older sister states at the end of the film, I'm not afraid of anybody anymore, because if I'm afraid, we won't get justice. Right now, I'm just going to speak the truth. What amazing courage for her to stand up, living inside the country, in a militarized area, to say that. And these are the kind of stories that we're trying to highlight in the film to garner more support for the organizations that you've seen portrayed in the film who are helping these women to empower themselves.
Who has the power to make Myanmar's government stop?
I think that the referral to the International Criminal Court with this particular case of the Rohingya ethnic cleansing, perhaps genocide, is certainly something that's going to have a far-reaching impact upon the Myanmar government. If nothing else, I think also for economic investment in that area. And I think that the Myanmar government is in the throes of a very difficult and flawed process of democratization with some of the decisions that have been taken by the civilian party of Aung San Suu Kyi, the National League for Democracy, albeit one that they have been placed in a difficult situation of walking a tightrope with the military. So I think that the international community must continue to exert any support that they can for those that are on the ground, human rights defenders and groups that are working with the people in these militarized areas, but at the same time continue with mechanisms such as the International Criminal Court and through the United Nations, as you saw with the fact-finding mission, the report of the United Nations fact-finding mission clearly stated that there was intent. This was not an accidental response, a normal military operation response. This was intent to wipe out an entire population. And the United Nations continues to have a role to play. Our government has a role to play. Unfortunately, Senator Mitch McConnell, who has tremendous sway in the Senate, in our government, has thwarted efforts for a congressional bill to impose sanctions that were lifted under the Obama administration because of what was hoped to be the progress. But I think that our government should reimpose those sanctions until and unless there is a safe and dignified pattern of return for the Rohingya and a cessation of war in Kachin State and security for all the ethnic groups in Burma. We shouldn't be engaging with that government as a normal government because they're not. They're still a military government.
All right. Jean Marie Hallisey, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having us. And we hope people can come to see the film. We'd love to have people come. Every film, we will have human rights activists from Burma speaking.
Our guest has been Jean Marie Hallisey. She's a human rights documentarian who has been filming ethnic cleansing on both sides of Myanmar's border. The new film is Mother, Daughter, Sister. It is showing Tuesday, October 16th at UC Berkeley at Bolt Hall. That starts at 5:30 p.m. Thursday, October 18th at Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Institute. That is at 4 p.m. And on Sunday, October 28th at 4 p.m. at the Roxy in San Francisco. Every one of those screenings I have just listed will be followed by a panel discussion of what's happening. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert.